how the Postal Service is gearing up for mail-in voting, how to care for older people in the pandemic. Pandemic DIY projects help construction materials industry flourish. First, we'll take a look at the numbers. From the Odessa American, Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 4,473. Ector County negative, 20,698 out of 25,493 tested, with 322 pending, 87 deaths. Recovered, 3,796. Active, 590. Midland County, 3,441 confirmed cases with 77 deaths. From the Texas Tribune, Texas reports over 14,000 total coronavirus deaths as hospitalizations and daily new cases continue to fall. 3,325 Texans are in the hospital for the coronavirus as of September 14th, 212 less than a week ago. They occupy 6% of hospital beds. 2,595 new cases were reported on September 14th. 14,211 Texans have died as of September 14th, 21 more deaths reported than the day before, and 719 more than a week ago. West Texas Intermediate is trading at $37.86, up 60 cents. Before we get to our reports, here are a few coronavirus briefs and short articles. At least 191,000 people have died of the coronavirus in the United States. More than 6.5 million cases have been detected since February. Michael Caputo, a top official overseeing the White House's coronavirus response, accused government scientists of sedition in a Facebook live chat. A poll released by Pew Research Center on Tuesday suggests that the international reputation of the United States has dropped to a new low amid a disorganized response to COVID-19 and high coronavirus-related deaths. States that have reopened bars saw their rate of coronavirus cases double within 3 weeks on average, a Washington Post analysis found. Nearly 550,000 children in the U.S. have been diagnosed with COVID-19 since the onset of the pandemic, according to two health groups. More than 40% of students in New York City public schools have requested the remote learning option. Nancy Pelosi wants the House to stay in session until a COVID-19 stimulus deal is reached. Now here are some short articles. Coronavirus pandemic has worsened mental health issues, expert says. The COVID-19 pandemic has worsened mental health issues, especially for young people of color, a mental health expert said Monday. Aisha Weerasinghe, who leads mental health work for the Center for Law and Social Policy, said that poor support for mental health in many communities has been made worse during the pandemic. She cited a lack of connectedness due to isolation, economic hardships, increased stress due to police brutality and its impacts, and anti-Asian violence and bullying. You pair that with increased anxiety and increased isolation, it's no wonder that there have been increased mental health conditions, adverse mental health conditions, which include self-harm and suicide ideation and attempts, Weerasinghe said at an American Foundation for Suicide Prevention briefing. She added that the lack of access to health care in many communities extends to a lack of mental health care. There have been, of course, through the pandemic, relaxed regulation in terms of telehealth, but when we're talking about people in low-income communities and households, they are privileges that only some of us are able to access, Weerasinghe said. Many of these communities were burdened with higher levels of mental health issues before the pandemic began. She cited data from recent years showing disproportionately high rates of suicide, self-harm, anxiety, and depression among young people of color, whose communities have been hit harder by the COVID-19 pandemic. We've seen an egregious increase in suicide rates for Native young people, said Weerasinghe, citing the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's fatal injury and violence data from 2016 to 2018. We've seen an increase in suicide rates in Black and Hispanic young men, and we've seen an increase in rates of non-fatal self-harm for all young people, with an increase particularly among black young people. The CDC recently released a report showing more people were thinking about suicide this June. Medicaid rolls swell amid the pandemic's historic job losses, straining state budgets. The unlikely portrait of Medicaid in the time of coronavirus looks like Jonathan Chapin living with his wife and 11-year-old daughter in a gated community in the Sierra Nevada foothills. Chapin had a thriving Reno, Nevada production company, We Ain't Saints, booking bands, managing weddings, hosting 600-strong karaoke nights at the Tahoe Biltmore Lodge and Casino. When the novel coronavirus came, forcing Northern Nevada's entertainment industry to go dark, he said, "Everything I knew all disappeared." The family's health insurance gone, along with their income. Chapin applied online for Medicaid on April 1st, the day after his wife's job ended and 3 days before he needed a molar pulled. By the time his mouth was throbbing, Chapin and his family had become early additions to Nevada's Medicaid rolls. Rolls swollen now to record levels, while pandemic-inflicted physical wounds have damaged the state's ability to afford the safety net health coverage. Economic devastation from pandemic is much worse than 2009 financial crisis, new report says. The blow inflicted by the coronavirus pandemic on the world's largest economies has been significantly worse than the 2009 financial crisis, according to a new report from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Nations in the group of 20, which includes China, Brazil, India, the United States, and the European Union, saw an unprecedented 6.9% decline in growth between April and June of this year. By contrast, the same economies took a dip of 1.9% during the first quarter of 2009, which marked the apex of the global financial crisis. India witnessed the most dramatic contraction in the second quarter of 2020, with a 25.2% drop in gross domestic product. Other countries reporting the worst declines were also among those logging in the highest tallies of infections, including Britain, Mexico, South Africa, and France. The only G20 nation reporting growth during the same time period was China, where the economy expanded by 11.5% as lockdown restrictions were lifted. The OECD released its findings on the same day that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation issued its annual Global Development Report, which concluded that the pandemic has stalled 20 years of progress and resulted in a 7% increase in extreme poverty. Longstanding inequalities have been made much worse by the pandemic, while marginal gains in alleviating issues such as hunger have been swiftly undone, the foundation found. "The pandemic not only stopped progress, it kicked it backward," Bill Gates told reporters on Monday, according to Reuters. The Asian Development Bank similarly said Tuesday that the region's developing economies have entered a recession, with Southeast Asia and tourism-dependent islands such as Fiji hit particularly hard. According to the BBC, the bank also optimistically predicted a rebound in 2021 and anticipates that Asia's economy will grow by 6.8% next year as China and India recover. CDC has been in trench warfare with U.S. administration, infectious disease specialist says. The people responsible for a weekly report released by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention have been in trench warfare with Washington officials over the report's scientific integrity, infectious disease specialist Dr. William Schaffner said Monday. Schaffner said he was very disturbed by the news that Trump-appointed officials at the Department of Health and Human Services pushed the CDC to change its weekly science reports so they would not undermine President Donald Trump's political messages. "I've since learned that the people who run that program, who put out that bulletin, have been in trench warfare with the folks in Washington," Schaffner told CNN. "They have struggled and succeeded, I think, in maintaining the scientific integrity of these reports, but that struggle continues." Schaffner, a professor of infectious diseases at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, who spent a brief time at CDC and who often works closely with the agency, added that it's totally inappropriate for Washington to try to influence the report, but the American people can still trust the information they are getting from the CDC. "We can trust what we're getting. These are professional people," said Schaffner. "They're just working on behalf of the American people." Bipartisan group of U.S. House members pressure party leaders to cut stimulus bill. A bipartisan group of U.S. House members is unveiling a sweeping proposal to inject up to $2 trillion in aid to the economy amid the coronavirus pandemic, a move aimed at jump-starting talks that have developed into bitter acrimony and finger-pointing between the White House and Democratic leaders in the heat of this election year. The proposal touches on many of the elements under discussion: aid to small businesses and schools, a new round of checks to Americans, more jobless benefits and funding to help with the November elections, while achieving bipartisan consensus on issues that have left the two sides bickering for the past several months, such as money for cash-strapped states and cities. While the proposal stands little chance of becoming law and just specifies overall numbers while leaving out many policy details, it represents a rare bipartisan breakthrough given Congress has been locked in a partisan impasse for months after Washington poured $3 trillion in the spring to help an economy ravaged by the pandemic. Delta Airlines says it has avoided most furloughs. Delta Airlines says most employees will not be furloughed when restrictions attached to the pandemic bailout funds expire on October 1st. In a new memo to employees, Delta CEO Ed Bastian said 40,000 employees took unpaid leaves of absence and one in five retired early or resigned. Bastian says that means company flight attendants and ground-based frontline employees in the U.S. will not be furloughed. But Bastian said he expects an overage of pilots come October 1st and that talks with its union continue. Now we'll bring you the first of our pre-recorded reports today. The first two are from the Texas Standard. This one is, Texas physicians say a Marshall Plan is needed to protect primary care practices.
This is the Texas Standard.
COVID-19 is almost certain to have an impact on the election, and many predict mayhem in the counting process. But the pandemic is already wreaking havoc on businesses large and small in Texas. While doctors have been critical in the fight against COVID-19, many Texas doctors, especially primary care providers, worry they may not survive economically. Now a group of them is calling for a primary care Marshall Plan, echoing the name given to the U.S. government's effort to help Europe recover in the aftermath of World War II. Tom Banning is CEO of the Texas Academy of Family Physicians. Tom, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Well, thank you for having me.
Before we get into this Marshall Plan idea, tell us a little bit about the financial situation for family practice doctors in Texas. Since the pandemic began, we've been hearing about how doctors and hospitals have been losing a lot of money, but specifically the situation on the ground for family medicine practitioners, what's it like?
It's been tough. You know, physicians, much like other small businesses, patient visits and patient volumes really dried up at the beginning of the pandemic in March and April. Practices saw a drop off in patient visits of, you know, around 50 to 70%. Now, some of those practices were able to pivot to offer telemedicine or virtual services, but it didn't make up for the loss in volume.
70% a drop off in business. That's surprising, especially given the demand for testing and other things. But I want to go back to the Marshall Plan concept. Could you take us through some of the points of the proposal?
Sure. One of the biggest issues that COVID-19 really exposed about our healthcare system is the way in which we pay for services has some perverse incentives. We're currently on what's known as a fee-for-service model, which doctors get paid more for doing high-cost, low-value services as opposed to with the buckets that primary care falls into that are generally thought of as low-cost, high-value services. So they're paid on patient visits, you know, churn, getting patients in and out of the door. They're not paid on keeping patients healthy and avoiding higher cost problems down the road. And, when the volume fell off 70%, it just exposed that that problem that we've been dealing with for frankly, a long time now.
So what would this plan do, though? What would the Marshall Plan, as you're describing it, do?
For about a decade, we have been testing alternative payment models for paying for physician services. That's manifested in things like accountable care organizations or episodes of care or bundled payments. Really, what we're proposing is to step back and look at how primary care is paid and begin to transition away from fee-for-service and look at prospective payment or primary care capitation, where primary care physicians would be paid a set amount of money per patient per month, like you do for a Netflix subscription. It frees up the physicians from having to come up with a billable event where they can spend time and resources on the care that the patient needs, as opposed to, again, trying to generate revenue.
This sounds like what you're proposing is a very long-term strategy, something that would require legislation, not an airlift. Just how much of an emergency is this?
I think over the next 2 years, you're going to see a mass consolidation in the physician market. They will either join larger groups, they'll join health systems, they'll be bought by private equity. It's going to be very difficult for, small independent practices to survive. The thing about healthcare is that nothing has ever happened quickly, whether that's clinical interventions. When you think about after a heart attack, you're supposed to take baby aspirin. It's well known. It took 16 years for that to happen. The Marshall Plan, if you look historically, that actually happened 5 years, or I believe it was 3 years, after World War II ended. Mm-hmm. Looking beyond the pandemic, we're fighting really two fronts, right? We're still dealing with the first wave of the disease now. What the Marshall Plan envisions is, looking beyond COVID-19 and how we restructure our healthcare system that has plagued us for a long time. But you can't change 20% of the economy, which is tied to healthcare, overnight.
Tom Banning is CEO of the Texas Academy of Family Physicians, a trade group representing family doctors in the state. Tom, thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Our next story is about a new poll that finds voters are split on health care despite COVID-19.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. Texas is suing, or I should say has been suing for some time, to strike down the Affordable Care Act. The Supreme Court is due to hear the case 1 week after Election Day. But that doesn't mean Democrats up and down ballot are waiting until after that date to make this an issue, as Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider explains.
During her first run for Congress in 2018, Democrat Lizzie Fletcher made protecting the Affordable Care Act one of her signature issues. She produced ads like this one, attacking her opponent, Republican Congressman John Culberson.
We all know our health care system is broken, and Congress could help fix it. But John Culberson is taking a wrecking ball to it.
Fletcher beat Culberson by 5 percentage points. She credits the win in large part to her stance on health care. She told me she sees that as the issue that could secure her re-election this year.
Our health care is on the ballot this year. I think that it is, again, at the top of everyone's minds, especially in light of the COVID-19 pandemic.
And not just because of the pandemic. She says health care is on the ballot because Republicans put it there.
Unfortunately, it is our state of Texas that's leading the charge in trying to repeal the entire Affordable Care Act. But we know that the Trump administration has refused to defend that law in court, that the president has said he does not support the Affordable Care Act and that the top of the ticket matters.
This election, Fletcher's opponent is Republican Wesley Hunt. He declined to speak for this story, though he emailed a statement saying that he would support protection for pre-existing conditions and work to lower the cost of prescription drugs. But just how big an issue is health care, and specifically the pandemic, likely to be for voters this time around? The Kaiser Family Foundation recently conducted a national poll and found that, as on so many issues, the electorate is polarized. Ashley Kurtzinger is with the foundation's polling unit.
What we found is for, you know, Democratic voters, the coronavirus is incredibly important to them. It's their top issue heading into the 2020 election. For Republican voters, it's less so. You know, a majority of Republican voters say it's the economy that's going to be driving their 2020 vote choice.
That encapsulates another closely watched congressional race in the Houston area, where Republican Congressman Dan Crenshaw is running for re-election.
You know, people care about their health. People care about recovering from the pandemic. They want their jobs back. They want a strong economy going forward.
Crenshaw is an outspoken opponent of the Affordable Care Act. He's drawn heavy criticism from Democrats for that, especially from his opponent, attorney and breast cancer survivor Seema Lajavardhan.
We live in a state that pretty much before the pandemic, one out of five Texans didn't have health care, and now it's one out of three. So it is extremely personal to me. I think we need to make sure that it's a human right, and we have to make sure that there is universal high-quality health care for everyone.
Lajavardhan also accuses Crenshaw of not taking the pandemic seriously enough. Crenshaw is having none of it.
I'm the guy who actually bought 50,000 masks back in March or April when it was really hard to get masks and distributed them throughout the community. So for all the talk and tweeting that my opponent does, she's one of the richest people in Houston. She easily could have done something like that but never did.
Both Dan Crenshaw, the Republican, and Lizzie Fletcher, the Democrat, are currently favored to win re-election. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
Now a short report from NPR. The pandemic is having tremendous financial impact on Houston, survey shows.
The economic fallout of the coronavirus continues for hundreds of millions of Americans. NPR surveyed people in the biggest U.S. cities to find out just how deep the financial wounds go. We found that half or more of American households have experienced a serious financial problem, and that those problems are most severe in Black and Latino households. One of the cities we focused on is Houston. Health reporter Sarah Willa Ernst of Houston Public Media has the latest from that city, which in recent years has suffered not one, but two disasters.
Near the George Bush Intercontinental Airport, Ramel Temez works at a warehouse helping prepare in-flight meals for United Airlines catering. But when the airline industry started slashing service this spring, Temez saw his hours cut to part-time, and it's taken a big financial hit on him.
Mostly worried about making rent and light. I'm barely scraping by.
Temez has been struggling to afford food and says he's sleeping more to conserve energy. He feels he's been in free fall financially.
A lot of people are looking for second jobs that are probably also part-time, so it's not really doing much good, and there's not really that much work right now.
Temez is one of many Houstonians finding themselves in this position. Over half of Houston households surveyed say someone has lost their job or their business, has been furloughed, or had hours reduced at their job during the outbreak. About a third report having trouble paying basic expenses like rent, utilities, and food. This data comes from a new report by NPR, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. The survey was conducted in New York, L.A., Chicago, and Houston in July and August. The report shows that these money struggles fall starkly along racial lines, especially in Houston. Around 80% of Black and Latino households said they're facing serious financial problems, compared to only 30% of white households. That's because white Houstonians tend to have office jobs.
In general, white-collar workers have been more protected from financial declines.
This is Bill Fulton, the director of the Kinder Institute for Urban Research at Rice University. He says office workers have been able to continue their work and stay in business. Service industry jobs, however, that require in-person interaction have struggled to stay open.
There are simply more Black and Hispanic folk who work in those jobs, and so they've been more heavily affected than office workers, who are mostly white and also Asian.
Fulton says the financial struggles were already there from the trauma of Hurricane Harvey in 2017. The coronavirus pandemic just piled on top of that.
So the two events together, that one followed the other so closely, that has made this such an extremely difficult situation here in Houston.
Take what happened to Pierre Laws. He's always struggled financially, working as a contract driver and cook. Then Harvey forced him into homelessness.
After Hurricane Harvey, and I lost my car because I lost everything. I couldn't get any help. I mean, I could get a plate of food. I was living in a tent under the bridge.
He was starting to get back on his feet earlier this year with food stamps and a new apartment through a local nonprofit. But then the pandemic hit, and now he's stuck again. He has underlying conditions that put him at higher risk for COVID-19. He has a history of lung disease, he has trouble walking, and he's HIV positive. But he says the only jobs available would put him on the front lines.
I go back and forth through, should I try to get a job? I can't get a job working from here because I don't have the internet, I don't have the money for the internet.
He needs that to go back to school for accounting. He wants a job where he can work from home, but he recently pawned his computer for $30.
But I mean, I don't want to be like this forever, and I want to be able to come out of this on top, not up under.
But for now, like other hard-strapped Houstonians, he's weighing the limited options in his head over and over again. I'm Sarah Willa Ernst in Houston.
In this story, Dr. Atul Gawande, who writes for The New Yorker, talks about the problem the U.S. is facing with coronavirus testing and what can be done to solve it.
A few weeks back, July, Dr. Atul Gawande went to see a lab, the Broad Institute, big academic lab affiliated with MIT and Harvard. Gawande was interested in coronavirus testing, why there is still not enough capacity in the U.S., why results can take so long. And what he saw was pretty mind-blowing. A lab with the capacity to process up to 35,000 tests a day, the capacity to expand that, given a few weeks' notice, to 100,000 tests per day. But when Gawande, a doctor in the Mass General Brigham Hospital system, visited, the Broad Institute was receiving just a few thousand test specimens per day. He saw a whole room of machines standing by, idle. Gawande writes about this in The New Yorker. Welcome back. Good to speak with you again.
It's great to be on.
I opened with that story from your piece because I got tested this summer, like a lot of people, and I found the process incredibly hard to navigate. It took too long. The idea that there are huge labs sitting around underutilized in this country is... the word frustrating hardly even begins to capture it. What is going on?
Well, early on, we didn't have enough labs that had testing up and running. We now have scores of labs that have capacity, and it's an implementation problem. What I mean by that is that we have places that don't have the operations to connect their testing prowess to the places and the people that need it. I compared it to an electric grid, right? You can have areas where there is an oversupply of electricity and places that are having blackouts. And unless you have the connections between them, they can't meet the need. So in New England, we're doing well with testing in general, but that supply can't be brought to the places where there is an adequate turnaround. Hmm. We're dominated in the United States by 3-4 big commercial labs, and they have the logistics. Number one, you have to have contracts with all the insurers to bill in our kind of crazy fragmented system. So part of the lunacy of our testing system is the lunacy of our healthcare system. And then the second part is they've got the transportation to pick up the tubes from all over the place, ship them, the barcoding onto the specimens. All of these labs that are available out there, they don't have that same capacity. But those 3-4 labs that are dominating, they're all telling us that if we're relying on just them, they're not going to have enough capacity for the fall. And so this is the problem we have to solve.
So it's a bunch of different interconnected pieces that we would need to fix, which makes me question a very optimistic premise you have, which is that we could fix this. We could fix this within weeks and have the testing capacity that we need. Do you think that's really true?
I'll give you an example. When I visited the Broad, that institute was doing 3,000 tests a day. Today, they hit 60,000 tests per day, supporting colleges, universities, nursing homes that need testing, and they're continuing to do it with a next-day turnaround time. Mm-hmm. I have spoken to labs in California, in Minnesota, in Alabama, that are bringing on similar levels of capacity, but don't have those interconnections. What did the Broad do? Well, for colleges and universities, you don't have to set up the billing system so that you can, you know, get it from the insurers. The universities and colleges are paying for it out of their own pocket. The Broad's costs are about a third of what the current going rates are. You know, usually the cost of processing a test is about $100 plus $50 to $80 for the logistics around that. They're charging $35 for test processing. And I've seen even lower costs that the other labs are willing to bring on board. if we make these interconnections come into place.
I want to talk through areas where you see possibilities. Pooled testing, for example. This is, just to explain briefly, you combine a large number of samples, like you get everybody in one dorm. You test all the samples together. If they come out negative, you can clear the whole group. If you turn up a positive, then you need to go back and test the individual samples and see who actually might be sick. How much promise do you see in pooled testing as one way out of this mess we're in?
I think it's hugely important. I've talked to a number of nursing homes where now they've been relatively clear. They need to keep testing on a regular basis. They might have been negative for the last 2 or 3 weeks. And that's a perfect setup. I spoke to one laboratory just yesterday, for example, where they will take 50 people. It'll be a saliva test. You spit into a vial. And then they combine the 50 vials into one and run it as one test for the same cost as you would run for a single person. And that allows you to clear those people, have a much lower cost. And then if the pool tests positive, then you can run the individual samples to see who was actually positive. You know, that's going to become a high value approach in places where the infection rates are low, but not zero. So you need to find ways to clear people.
What about testing sewage? You write about a success story out of the University of Arizona on that front.
Yeah, University of Arizona has been doing sewage testing, and it turned out that the sewage test picked up virus in the wastewater outflow from one of the dormitories. They quickly tested all 300-plus people in the dorm and found there were two active infections and therefore were able to stop an outbreak. I think this approach is going to become very important in places where you have dormitories, people living in nursing homes, congregant living group homes, jails, where you could be deploying that wastewater testing capability to screen and then pick up when you start to have an outbreak and then go to the swab testing. That could increase our capacity in lots of ways, and also just the burden of doing these kinds of tests.
I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is that there's no quick fix here. I think we've all come to terms with that. But it's going to be this whole landscape of things that needs to get changed.
Yes, but I want to push back. This can happen quickly, and this is what drives me a little bit crazy, with a war footing effort. And right now, you know, we're at the point of about to have 200,000 deaths. This is as big as any war casualty situation we've ever had. There is no reason we could not be deploying on a national scale the dedicated effort to connect these dots and make this work.
Can you speak to the sense of urgency that you feel? And we keep hearing dire warnings about a second wave and the flu season nearly upon us, and that we may be looking at one of the worst falls, worst winters in American history.
Well, we're in the worst time. I mean, we already are experiencing a steady level of death that is not being dealt with. It is urgent that we now start to bring this capacity online. We could have avoided the last 100,000 deaths with an early testing capability. The next 100,000 will happen over the next 3 to 4 months. And so, you know, by the time we get to the new year, will we have 300,000 deaths? I fear we will, simply because we're not picking up and collectively pulling together a national effort to make these basic steps happen.
Atul Gawande, he's a surgeon at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and a staff writer at The New Yorker. Dr. Gawande, thank you.
Thank you.
Now we're going to bring you two reports related to vaccines. The first is how vaccine skepticism may affect efforts to combat the coronavirus pandemic. And then the story after that will be about how the Army are bringing together resources to help in the race for a coronavirus vaccine.
Let's say it's 2021. Scientists have already developed and marketed a vaccine for COVID-19. Now they face a new problem, convincing people to actually get vaccinated with it. A Gallup poll last month found that more than 1 in 3 Americans would not get an FDA-approved coronavirus vaccine, even for free. Psychology professor Dolores Alboracin studies behavior and medicine at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She spoke with our co-host Audie Cornish earlier today about why some people are skeptical of vaccines.
We know that it can take years to develop and distribute a safe vaccine to everyone. And then, of course, just this week, the pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca announced that it was hitting pause on its trial to investigate an unexplained illness in one of its participants. So there are people who are concerned about potential long-term side effects, who are worried about this process being rushed. Does that boost people's doubts? And is that wrong?
Well, I think it's completely normal, and we should all be looking at side effects for any pharmaceutical product that we consume, right? So among those who hesitate, 60% fear side effects, 37% are not afraid, but they just don't think it will work. And then you have 20% who are the staunch opposers, sort of the anti-vax group, and that's a small group. So for the folks who are fearing side effects, I think news like the one you're referring to are going to be extremely influential, and they connect with some pretty strong and persuasive narratives about big pharma. And we have data, even my own data with colleagues at the University of Pennsylvania, showing that exposure to social media earlier on actually predicts vaccination intentions in the domain of flu later on. So there's pretty good data that those groups are not trivial.
Wait, so help me understand this. Essentially, if someone sees anti-vaccination social media posts, that can actually influence their own decision about whether or not to accept a vaccine?
Yes, it's similar to that. So we surveyed 3,000 participants over 1 year following the flu season, 12 months. So what we observe is what is going on Twitter, what misinformation about vaccines is being distributed, and where. So when you look at that, and then you look at whoever lives in a county that has that kind of big pharma conspiracy misinformation circulating on Twitter are less likely to get the flu shot a few months later, except that they are not affected if they have discussions in real life. So if they can discuss this information with friends, family, their physicians, then they're less persuaded by the misinformation. But otherwise, the misinformation they encounter regionally affects them.
What does all this mean for the public information campaign? How should authorities, public health officials, go about trying to convince people to embrace a vaccine should one come along?
So the strategy, in my view, should be to communicate a norm clearly. So you need to tell people that everybody wants it. We all like it. We must have it. So something quite different from what we saw with wearing masks, where there was a lot more hesitation in the messaging, right? And contradictions over months. So clear norm. You also need to be, of course, correcting for misinformation systematically every day through health education, in schools, at work, everywhere. We've seen an explosion of misinformation and what the WHO has referred to as an infodemic. And if we don't eradicate it, we'll make it very difficult to end the COVID-19 pandemic.
That was Dolores Albarracin. She's a professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Thank you for speaking with us.
Thank you.
There's been a lot of focus on private industry in the race for a coronavirus vaccine, but the U.S. military is also involved, working with private industry to help create a vaccine for now. The Army is also working on its own vaccine for future strains of the coronavirus. NPR's Tom Bowman checked out the effort at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research just outside Washington.
Aggie Hadutsky opens a freezer and takes out boxes of DNA. She's a research scientist and part of a team making a COVID vaccine. She places a small, clear plastic tray on the table of her lab. It's dimpled. Pale yellow fluid can be seen under the dozens of dimples.
Some of these are much more yellow than the others. Exactly. What does that mean when it's more yellow?
More yellow means more protein. So we're basically trying to get mammalian cells to generate this protein for us, which would then eventually be used as the vaccine in a clinical trial. So it kind of looks like the spike the way it does in the real virus.
The idea is that the immune system would get to know this protein through the vaccine, and when the real virus hits, the immune system would know how to fight it. Hejduczki became fascinated with viruses as a young girl in Hungary, watching her pathologist mother work on AIDS victims back in the early 1980s.
So even, you know, when the world didn't necessarily know about that this virus is happening, like, that was our dinner table conversation.
Now she has a young daughter. Hejduczki's voice breaks when she talks about the effect the virus is having on her work and family life.
It's hard because our whole days have been upside down, crazy hours, super amount of stress. But then, you know, when I go home, dealing with the whole thing, like going to Trader Joe's is like a two-hour excursion now, you know. And I have a kid who has been at home from school. I have to kind of explain to her what's going on.
The Army's vaccine she's working on will take some time and is expected to target any future coronaviruses. Human trials aren't expected to start until later in the fall. A supply cart rolls down the long corridors at the Institute, past labs. There are closed doors with small signs on the wall. One says viral diseases, another simply malaria. Inside one of these offices is a scientist heading Army efforts to aid in the race for a vaccine for the current pandemic, Kayvon Majarid. He's a large man with wireless glasses and an easygoing manner. His parents came from Iran to New York back in the 1970s. He became interested in vaccines as a medical student.
I decided that I wanted to work on vaccines because it is the most cost-effective and impactful public health tool that we have to saving lives.
Majarid is developing the Army's future vaccine, but is also part of Operation Warp Speed, the government's efforts to help private companies in the U.S. and internationally create coronavirus vaccines. That means sharing the Army's expertise, labs, research animals, locations for human trials in Washington, D.C., San Diego, and San Antonio. He and other officials liking the effort to a horse race, with multiple companies coming out of the gate at the same time.
We're interested in a horse, at least one horse, making it across the finish line as fast as possible and being safe and effective and accessible for our entire population.
Right now, several companies are working on the final phase three of human trials in developing a vaccine.
It's not like after the phase three trial, hey, the vaccine is ready for everyone. We start to phase it into the population, and we still collect information on how people are responding to that vaccine until we get to a point where it becomes broadly available to the entire population.
The Army has a long history of producing vaccines. Majarid worked on vaccines for Zika and MERS, and one recently approved for Ebola. And then there's Walter Reed, the namesake. He was an Army major in the early 1900s who discovered that yellow fever was spread by mosquitoes, not poor sanitation as some believed at the time. The virus had a devastating effect on soldiers and those working in tropical climates.
So we sprayed and killed all the mosquitoes. People weren't dying. They built the Panama Canal.
My name is Nelson Michael. I am the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research here at the Walter Reed Army Institute of Research.
There were colored maps of Africa and the world in Michael's office, a picture of him in his uniform when he was an Army colonel. He's often on the phone talking with participants of Operation Warp Speed, a name that has caused some to worry that speed has more to do with politics than science.
There's been a lot of concern about what's being sacrificed by moving so quickly. And I can tell you one thing is very clear, it's being sacrificed, and it's money.
He says in the past, vaccine development would take so long, often years, in part because companies and governments were wary of making an investment. The coronavirus changed all that.
Now everyone's throwing financial caution to the winds, and billions of dollars are in play. But now you have, of course, a worldwide pandemic that's costing trillions of dollars and impacting millions of people's lives.
Michael says the government is working to make sure the human trials are diverse, including reaching out to the Latinx, African American, and Native American communities. But he says there's an even greater challenge once a vaccine is approved.
I am more concerned about, you know, how we're going to execute a vaccine campaign than I am about how we're going to test these vaccines. How are we going to convince Americans that they should sign up for their vaccine?
Some polls show at least 30% of Americans say they won't take the vaccine. There are scientists who say at least 40% of Americans must take it. Michael puts that percentage even higher.
What we really need is to have somewhere between 70 and 90% of Americans that either have been vaccinated and have immunity that way, or have been exposed and survived and have immunity because of natural infection.
A vaccine from at least one of the private companies is expected early next year. No matter what, a strong public health campaign will be needed, Michael says, to convince Americans the vaccine is safe and effective. Tom Bowman, NPR News.
The pandemic has changed all of our lives, our daily lives, how we do things. We have a series of reports now about how the pandemic is changing things with people, businesses, even the courts. We may not get to every one of them today, but what we don't, we'll bring you tomorrow. Our first story is about daily life being a logistical challenge for moms. It's a learning curve, and NPR highlights this one Atlanta mom story.
One family, two parents with two full-time jobs, two daughters, 3 and 7 years old, and a dog. Daily life for Farrah Jackson in Atlanta is a logistical challenge right now. She's next up in our Learning Curve series. We've heard from a single mother in North Carolina, a teacher in California, and now a mom who has resources and family help and still feels overwhelmed with virtual learning. Farrah's husband travels a lot for work, even during the pandemic. She's in marketing and often on the phone all day.
I mostly work in our home office, basically an L-shaped built-in desk situation. So our oldest, when we realized that she wouldn't be going back to school in person, you know, we converted like a little space in her room. So she has like a new desk and all of her supplies. And then our three-year-old goes to daycare.
Despite the planning and setup, the day school actually started, things got real.
So day one, we get up early, we take our first day of school pictures. We're very excited. And they're using Zoom and then Google Classroom. So that day, the first day of school, Zoom was having a global outage. Half of the students could log on and the other half couldn't. It was absolutely crazy. So I was on the phone with her teachers. I was texting them. I was emailing the vice principal and the principal, trying to figure out what we're supposed to do. And I mean, my husband and I were both literally for 4 hours, I felt like that day, trying to get her logged on and stay on. It was a lot, just trying to figure out where to go and what the schedule was. And, you know, we were prepared. We had everything printed out and all of our passwords and codes, and we still had trouble.
So there's a lot of technology she has access to try to make this easier, right? Can you tell me what she's got?
So she still had her school iPad. So we did all the preparation over that weekend of like restarting and figuring out passwords and all of that. She has her own personal iPad Pro, because what we found in the spring was sometimes the school iPad wouldn't work. It wouldn't log on to everything that was required for classwork or homework. And then on top of that, she has an Apple computer desktop. So between having all of those devices and both parents in the room for 4 hours, it's still, that first day was a nightmare. But as time has gone on, it's gotten a little bit easier.
So you feel at this point, now that you're 3 weeks in, do you feel like you've got a rhythm to this? I mean, how, you sound okay. Are you okay?
It's a lot. So, I mean, I couldn't, like my husband and I feel like every night, usually around midnight, we are strategizing for the next day. Because while I work from home, there's still things that I need to do during the day. So typically what happens is, like this morning, my husband was the one that got up early and got the girls dressed. While he was doing that, I was downstairs making breakfast. And then normally I have to log into my older daughter's Zoom meeting. I try to do 20 minutes before the start of school, because sometimes her school iPad can take that long to like connect to
load?
Zoom. Oh, yeah. And so then once she's good, then my husband is then, like this morning, dropped off our little one at daycare. Then it's my turn then to get dressed. And then my mom is retired, so she helps us. So between my mom and I, we have to figure out who's walking our dog. And then usually I have meetings from 9 to 5 or whatever. We just do the best we can. And the only way we can do it is every day we have to figure out the schedule and every week. And
that is a lot.
And you guys are set up for success of all the different parenting situations. I mean, you guys have two incomes. You've got outside help from family. And it's still insanely stressful.
Even with that. So, exactly. And I feel very fortunate of our situation. But you're right. I don't know how. It's a lot to ask. I mean, I do feel extremely fortunate that we're able to, you know, keep our girls safe in the best way that we can, but also hopefully give her the education that she needs.
Farah and her family are Black. Statistically speaking, they are more likely to get COVID than people who are white. For Farah, that knowledge and the fact that her job and her income help protect her from that risk is heavy.
I do think that that weighs on us. I think, unfortunately, that that group has had a higher proportion of the risk factors like obesity or diabetes. I don't fall into those categories, so I feel like a little bit more removed from it because I don't feel like I'm in a risk category only because I'm Black. I also feel that my job doesn't put me at risk. When I look at other people that have, I don't know, like more like a white collar type of job, their risk, I feel like, is similar to my risk.
So are you preparing for the whole academic year to be virtual? How do you, what are you psychologically preparing for over the next year?
So I haven't seen any fundamental changes in how people at least feel like they're taking it seriously. I don't, I mean, when I walk around, people are out and about as if COVID is over. So that doesn't give me a lot of hope that our community is doing enough. I mean, my daughter, even this morning, mentioned, I can't wait till I get to go back to school. I mean, I would love for that to happen, but I don't feel hopeful that it's gonna happen.
That's Farah Jackson in Atlanta, Georgia. You can hear more from our series Learning Curve Sunday on Weekend Edition.
Another entity that has had to change the way they do things is the court system. Many courtrooms had to close at the onset of the pandemic, and now they're struggling to juggle a backlog of cases. Here's how they're trying to resume in-person proceedings as safely as possible.
Along with so much of American life, the pandemic stopped ordinary court proceedings. Now states and cities have resumed operations, hearing new cases plus the backlog of old ones. Beth Fertig of our member station WNYC watched a New York City court trying to safely do business.
Brooklyn's busy housing court had just started hearing cases again when the federal government announced a moratorium on evictions. Judges were back in courtrooms.
This is the quietest trial I've ever had.
Judge Hila Kapel took a break from her first trial since March. Because Brooklyn's notoriously cramped housing court wasn't fit to reopen in a pandemic, trials were moved to the criminal court building a few blocks away with much bigger courtrooms and safety features. Desks were being wiped while we talked.
The bench, witness stand, and court attorney area and other desks in the courtroom all have plexiglass around them and are more than 6 feet apart from each other.
Like everyone else here, Kapel was wearing a mask. There was just one trial that day. One sister wanted to evict the other from a building they used to own together. Attorney Dominic Napolitano raised concerns with Kapel that his client couldn't sit next to him.
My client is not sitting with me at counsel table, because she can't be sitting here with me at counsel table from what I understand.
The judge had suggestions.
You could write on a notepad and exchange them. Another thing that we can do is I can permit texting.
The trial proceeded with lots of note-taking. Despite safety precautions in the housing and criminal courts, there isn't a lot of business being conducted in person each day. Grand juries are hearing evidence and making indictments, and some felony cases are being called in for procedural hearings. But there are still no jury trials. Arraignments are still virtual, and so are most other cases. But that requires having the right technology.
Access to a computer,
access to a smartphone. Many of my clients don't have regular access to the internet.
Brooklyn Legal Services lawyer Alex Drimmel says that's an obstacle to virtual trials in a lot of courts. Even though she says her clients need this option, they're mostly people of color who were disproportionately affected by the coronavirus and afraid to take mass transit. Attorneys also worry about the potential for witness coaching in online trials, when you can't see if anyone else may be present. Housing court trials are expected to slow down now that the CDC has made it much harder to evict tenants affected by the coronavirus. But with other cases ramping up, Paula Hannaford-Agor of the National Center for State Courts says virtual hearings are the only way for courts to move forward in a pandemic. She says some courts are letting those without the right technology use computers at libraries and community centers to bridge the digital divide. In New York City, public defenders and court officers have complained about poor ventilation in the courts and insufficient protections. But the sisters who sat on opposing sides for their trial in Brooklyn, Lucy Wade and Evelyn Collier, agreed they felt safe.
I thought when I walked in, it was going to be a room full of people. Then I would have been concerned.
You didn't have to worry about 25 other people standing by the door waiting to get in.
The New York court system knows these in-person proceedings can only happen safely if it continues to limit the number of people in each building. But attorneys are hoping to steer as many as they can to virtual hearings. For NPR News, I'm Beth Fertig in New York.
Because we're almost out of time, I'll have to take some of the reports I wanted to bring you today and play them tomorrow instead. But we do have one more story, and again, it's kind of a way things have changed with the pandemic, and that's DIY projects. In fact, I can tell you in my own home, my wife, for example, is enjoying home improvement shows, especially Chip and Joanna Gaines's show from Waco. She's binge-watching all of those seasons right now. Well, many people are doing the same thing, and they're thinking about their homes, and that has meant that DIY projects are helping construction materials industries flourish. Here's this from NPR.
All across the country, there's a lot of construction going on in backyards, basements, and spare rooms as homeowners pour money and energy into their properties. This reaction to the pandemic is sparking good times for some retailers and pushing the costs of materials, such as lumber, through the roof. Frank Morris of member station KCU. Our reports.
At John Buehr's house in Kansas City, it's busy and noisy these days. The construction projects here span from upstairs down to the basement.
As soon as COVID hit, we needed someplace the kids could play. So we put a playhouse down there first and then found the kids liked it so much that we went ahead and built a living room. And then my wife needed the space to work.
Buehr's standing in an unfinished space above his garage where he's building an office for his wife and an apartment to accommodate grandparents on extended babysitting visits.
This all kind of became immediately necessary thanks to COVID.
COVID has sparked an unprecedented building boom, according to Max Anderson, chief economist at Porch.com.
This is all-time high in terms of measured history in the United States. This is the highest level of home improvement spending we've ever seen.
Anderson says demand for home improvement has roughly doubled. 3 out of 4 homeowners his company surveyed have completed a major project this year. People like Wanda Taylor in Kansas City are resetting their priorities.
My partner and I, we like to travel quite a bit. We like to travel. We like theater. We like live music. And so that's how we spend our money. But then suddenly all that stopped. And so if I can't travel, then I chose to put my energy in the place where I am.
Her house, that is. Taylor has turned a little used basement into a cozy den and pantry. A block away, Astoria Camille, furloughed from a restaurant job last spring, is reclaiming unused space outdoors.
Used to be a backyard. Now it's a summer oasis with a dipping pool that my mom likes.
Camille reused a big round plastic stock tank, the kind cattle normally drink from, instead of buying a new swimming pool.
And 53 bags of pea gravel because all the stores with COVID spring were sold out of the river rock that we wanted.
And as the pandemic drags on, demand for some building supplies keeps mounting.
How can we help you, sir?
At Mac True Value Hardware in Mission, Kansas, employee Patty Peters is having a hard time filling the shelves.
Well, I mean, some of the stuff still is gone. We haven't been able to restock it. Like all of the fencing, that's been gone since early April.
Around the store, gaps on the shelves signal shortages of everything from seeds to spray paint. Shortages aside, all this demand has been a boom for hardware stores.